gifts, who wanted only to be with her on a Friday night, not sweating in a room full of cousins, everyone laughing and drinking and talking too much as if they hadn't seen one another the day before. The face she pictured belonged to Killian, the boy who kissed her on the ship. He was shy like she was, or so he said. She knew that she didn't know anything about him, really. But sometimes, Nora wondered what he was doing, if he had found a girl to love, if he had stopped feeling homesick by now. While Teresa was away, Nora often imagined her homecoming, her sister flush with gratitude for all they had done. But Teresa seemed angry most of the time. She didn't seem to understand what any of it meant. She didn't believe that it was settled, that the baby was Nora and Charlie's now. Teresa said something that first afternoon home about how she and Patrick would board a bus and go away, as if they had anywhere to go. Nora rebuked her and then felt sorry for it. She said, "We will raise him together." Charlie gave her a look that said she had made a mistake, saying a thing like that. Teresa thought his birth was a miracle. She talked nonsense about a vision of the Virgin Mary, how the miraculous medal the nurses had pinned to the baby's diaper was a sign. Even for Nora, there was a sense of movement to it all at first, like it wasn't quite settled yet, like maybe they could fix it. They still hadn't realized there was no way the arrangement could work. They put Patrick in the bedroom down the hall. They turned the dining room into Teresa's room. "For now," Nora said. Mrs. Quinlan insisted on hosting the christening party. Aunt Nellie and Nora would have to be churched ahead of it. "What's churched?" Teresa asked. "A ceremony where a new mother is cleansed. The priest says a blessing that she made it through the birth. It's private, but you should come to support your sister." On a stifling hot Saturday morning, Aunt Nellie and Mrs. Quinlan met Nora and Teresa at the church. All four of them covered their heads with silk scarves. Teresa's stomach still bulged out slightly beneath the light fabric of her dress. Her breasts were fuller than before. Nora wondered if the others noticed. She hadn't known how of the body it all would be. She herself still wore the baggy dresses she'd been in for months. She was as slim as ever, and this people did comment on, praising her for the good fortune of having a figure that barely showed the strain of pregnancy, of birth. Nora sweated now. Her skirt clung to the backs of her legs. Kitty was watching the baby for an hour. It was the first time in 3 weeks that Nora had been apart from him. She felt as if she had escaped. They went up the church steps and into the vestibule. The lights were low. It was much cooler there than it was outside. Aunt Nellie opened the door that led into the church. Mrs. Quinlan and Teresa went through, but when Nora tried to follow, Aunt Nellie held out her hand.
"No," she said, "you wait here. That's the point. You can't come in until he's purified you."
Aunt Nellie followed the others, the door closing behind her with a boom. A moment later, she returned.
"Take this," she said.
She handed Nora a lighted candle and left again. Nora stood there, holding it, waiting. Finally, the priest came in. Nora had smiled at him many times after a Sunday Mass, in this very room, Charlie shaking his hand. But now he bore a solemn expression. She knew somehow that she was not to say a word. He wore all white and held a golden chalice. He dipped his finger into it and made a cross on her forehead, the cool holy water dripping down her nose.
"The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof," he said. "Enter thou into the temple of God. Adore the Son of the Blessed Virgin Mary, who has given thee fruitfulness of offspring."
It was too intimate a moment, the smell of his breath in her face. Nora thought this might be her only chance to say that they had lied. It was one thing to lie to the family, quite another to lie to God himself. But she couldn't say it. He offered her the edge of his robe, and she took hold of it. The priest led her into the church, cold and dark and empty, but for the three heads in the first pew, the flickering votives at the back of the room. In silence, he led Nora to the altar, and then he instructed her to kneel. As he prayed over her, she looked out and saw her sister's eyes glowing in the candlelight. Nora had to leave her job to stay home with the baby. There were days when she spoke to no one but the coal man and others when Charlie's cousins from Ireland overtook the rooms of her apartment. They were teenagers, mostly, their first time away from home. They expected her to cook for them, to clean up their messes. When their boisterous conversations made Nora feel like the odd man out in her own kitchen, she journeyed to Hull in her mind. That night with Teresa, the last time she had seen her sister happy, the beach and the cinema and the roller coaster, the houses crowded on the hills like teeth, the people inside them deciding for themselves how to pass the time. She could cry for hours, letting her resentments unspool. During the day, she thought of how her sister's life hadn't changed at all. Nora was the one making the sacrifices. She was the one to suffer for Teresa's sins. Her life in the house was a world away from what people knew of her in the street.
"Nora, he's beautiful," they said when she pushed the baby in his pram. "That dark hair, those eyes."
She smiled and thanked them, knowing just who the child resembled. Women talked about good babies and fussy ones. Nora couldn't tell the difference. Patrick cried all day. She wasn't any good at soothing him. The baby, if not her baby, was her family. She ought to love him more. But she couldn't help thinking of him as a child she was minding, waiting for the moment when he was no longer her concern. In the evenings, Teresa cared for him. Nora knew far better what to do with an infant, but Teresa knew her own baby best. Or anyway, he wanted her most. Every night, several times, Nora was awakened by his cries. Right away, she would hear Teresa's footsteps padding down the hall. She heard her sister singing to him, talking to him. She felt the deepest sadness then, for all of them, for herself and for Charlie, that this had been thrust upon them, for Patrick, who might only ever know a mother who didn't love him. Most of all, for her sister, who loved the child so much, who was only a child herself. One morning in early November, the toaster went up in flames. Nora screamed and dumped a sack of flour on it to put out the fire. White dust wafted through the kitchen like snow, landing on every surface, the floor and the table and the baby's eyelashes. It took her half an hour to clean it up, Patrick wailing all the while. They had a new washing machine in the cellar, but no dryer. Earlier, Nora had hung all their clothes out as she usually did. She went back to fetch them in the afternoon while the baby slept, and found that they had frozen solid on the line. She gathered them up anyway, stormed up the stairs in a state. When she reached the door to her apartment, Mrs. Quinlan stood there, her cheeks wet with tears. For a moment, Nora thought their secret had been discovered. But then Mrs. Quinlan blinked and said, voice trembling, "My mother's died." She held a small rectangular box. "Her prayer cards," Mrs. Quinlan said. "I think she would have liked for Teresa to have them. She was the only one who ever showed an interest. My mother is so fond of you girls. Was so fond." Nora took the box. She had often seen Aunt Nellie spreading the cards out on the dining room table in the evenings. It seemed impossible that she could be gone. "I'll give them to her," Nora said. "I'm so sorry. Do you want to come in? I can help with anything you need." The next day, she stood in awe of the scene at Murphy's funeral home, the whole place teeming with flowers. Aunt Nellie wore a fine suit in her casket. Nora had never seen anything like it. In Ireland, there would have been just a wreath or two to adorn the grave. The wake would have happened at home. She was 7 years old when her mother died. Old ladies from the church came to dress her in a robe and fresh slippers, to lay her out on her bed like she was only going off for a nap. Afterward, they sat in the kitchen drinking tea with Nora's gran, who kept saying, "It isn't right, losing a child," as if she might convince God of his mistake and have her daughter back. The door to the house was left open. All day, people came in and walked straight to the bedroom to see her. Nora felt like a ghost. She wondered if she, too, had died. Hardly anyone took note of her except to frown and say, "Poor girl," or, "You mind your father now. Look after your brother and sister." Men came in the evening. They had real drinks and joined her father to sit up all night with the body. They spoke in whispers. In the morning, she was bold enough to approach the bed. Her father did not try to stop her. Nora went up close. She touched her mother's cheek. Aunt Nellie's funeral was a solemn high mass. As the priest spoke in Latin, his back to the congregation, Nora remembered how Aunt Nellie told her that before she came to Boston, her family had given her an American wake. "I was as good as dead to them," Aunt Nellie said. "It'll be easier for a girl like you to get back there eventually." Nora wondered at the time why Aunt Nellie couldn't travel home to Ireland now as easily as she herself could. In the church pew, the answer came. Aunt Nellie no longer had anyone to go back to. She had liked to tease the young people in the family about how easy it was nowadays. Aunt Nellie hadn't gone through New York, but straight from Cove to Massachusetts. She told Nora that when she and her family arrived at the port in New Bedford, a woman wasn't allowed to leave without a male relative. Aunt Nellie was 15. Her older brother was asked, "How much is 2 and 2? How much is 3 and 5? Aunt Nellie was asked, "Do you wash a staircase from top to bottom or bottom to top?" One brother, 12 years old, got sick with an eye infection on the boat ride over and was denied entry. Sent back to Ireland alone. The family never saw him again. Nora said she didn't know how they could bear it. or how Aunt Nellie managed to remain so devout. Aunt Nellie just shrugged and said,
"Live long enough, and life teaches you that God is not your lucky rabbit foot."
Nora thought of this as she sat in the church, bouncing her sister's child on her lap. The baby began to shriek during the eulogy. People turned, and Nora felt her face and neck go red. She tried to quiet him. She looked over at Teresa, who stared straight ahead. They went back to Mrs. Quinlan's house after. Mrs. Quinlan put her head down to cry as she filled a red Coleman cooler with cans of Narragansett. Nora told her to sit down, and she took over, lining up several bottles of Seagram 7 on the table, setting out the cake and salad, the roast chicken and potatoes that Mrs. Quinlan had made.
"The love's gone out of her cooking,"
Charlie whispered, but everyone ate just the same. The gathering lasted all afternoon and well into the night. There was music in the parlor. Instruments Nora hadn't seen since she left home were pulled out from under beds and from high shelves in closets, taken from their cases, and played to perfection. Afterward, the women congregated in the kitchen as usual. Mrs. Quinlan asked to hold Patrick.
"He's a beautiful boy, Nora," she said.
Everyone nodded and clucked in agreement. Nora met Teresa's eye and smiled. Her sister looked down at the floor. Babs leaned against the cabinets, several whiskies in. She bounced her own fat baby on her hip. Connor had weighed 11 pounds when he was born.
"Such a big boy," someone said, tickling his chin. "The birth must have been excruciating."
"No," Babs said. "I had the twilight sleep. I woke up and my hair was done and I was holding a baby in my arms. It was after that I felt it all."
Nora stared at her, wondering what twilight sleep was. Babs caught her looking.
"Nora had a much easier time of it," she said. "Her Patrick was a prince from the start, as we all know."
Nora tried to smile. Her husband had made up a story about the birth. When Lawrence asked how long it lasted, Charlie said,
15 minutes.
She supposed he had no clue how long these things actually took.
"That's all?" Lawrence had said.
"Yes," Charlie said. "My boy couldn't wait to greet the world."
Babs seemed to resent Nora, and Nora in turn felt guilty for the ease of the birth that had never actually occurred. Babs said now,
"But Nora, you have a secret, don't you?"
Nora knew her blushing had once again betrayed her. She met Teresa's eye.
"Babs, leave it alone," Mrs. Quinlan said.
"I'm just saying. You were married in April, and Patrick was born in August. Is that why you didn't wear white on your wedding day?"
The other women laughed in a way that let Nora know they'd been discussing it. She was 7 months married and still a virgin, and now they would accuse her of this. She wasn't sure whether to laugh or cry. Nora ran upstairs to the room that had once belonged to her and to her sister. Kitty lived there alone now, for the time being. She could hear Babs calling,
"I was only teasing. Come back."
Then footsteps on the stairs. A moment later, Kitty entered the room.
"Don't worry about her. She's a twit and everyone knows it."
"Is it what they're all thinking?" Nora asked.
"It doesn't matter what they're thinking. You've got to learn to stand up for yourself, Nora. This family has a way of forgetting what it doesn't want to know. A year from now, no one will recall that there was ever anything funny about it."
Nora thought of something that hadn't occurred to her before. though it should have. Kitty knew everything. She suddenly felt afraid of her. And envious, too. Kitty had walked away from her marriage. And yes, those women in the kitchen whispered about it all the time. But what did Kitty care? She was free. Babs walked in.
"Don't be mad at me," she cooed. "It was a joke. I'm just jealous. Sometimes I wonder how you and I went through the same thing. I'm still lugging around all these extra pounds. You had such an easy time of it. I said to Lawrence the other night when we saw you, did Nora even have that baby, or was he left on her doorstep by a stork? You didn't put on an ounce."
Nora felt exhausted. She wondered how much longer she could keep up the lie, even as she understood that she had committed herself to it for life. She had wanted to take shame off of her sister, and she had wanted Teresa to know her son. She hadn't considered herself. The shame this would bring upon her. The fact that they would all know there was something funny about it.
"You never saw Nora at the beach," Kitty said. "She was as big as a house when she got those baggy dresses off. The size of her ankles, my God. Sorry, Nora."
Nora looked at Kitty, grateful.
"It's all right," she said. "You're only telling the truth."
Her sister was quiet on the walk home. She refused to look Nora in the eye. Charlie went to bed as soon as they got in, so it was just the two of them, Nora and Teresa, standing in the kitchen. Nora handed Patrick to her sister. The weight of him stayed in her arms. She shook them out at her sides. Her back ached. Her head felt like it was about to split open.
"You love that they all think you're such a fine mother," Teresa said. "You love when they tell you how beautiful he is."
"Keep your voice down."
"Why? You're afraid someone will hear?"
"You ungrateful thing," Nora said. "Do you know what they all think of me because of you? I never wanted any of this."
"Say it. You never wanted him."
"Of course I don't want him."
She went into her room and slammed the door. Charlie was awake. He looked at her. Nora wanted to tell him what Babs had said, but she couldn't. She got straight into bed and closed her eyes. Around midnight, she heard the baby shriek. Patrick's cries went on and on. Nora flipped from one side to the other. She put a pillow over her head. The baby kept crying. She wondered how long he could go on like that before he would suffocate. Charlie stirred. Nora sighed. She threw back the covers and stormed down the hall to Patrick's room. He lay in his crib, eyes open wide, tears on his cheeks, arms outstretched to her. Nora picked him up, kissed him.
"All right," she said. "You're all right now. Where's your fool mother? Let's wake her, shall we?"
She went toward Teresa's room, taking in the smell of the baby, giving herself over to the strange hour. Nora didn't bother to knock. She just opened the door and started speaking.
"The baby needs..."
The room was empty. Nora thought of Walter, of those dances on Dudley Street. Would her sister be stupid enough to return there? Then she saw the piece of paper on the still-made bed. She went closer. Nora looked down and read what her sister had written.
"Please make sure he knows how loved he is until I come back."
She ran downstairs, calling out to the neighbors, not caring if she woke them, no longer herself. Someone must know something. But no one in the house had seen Teresa go. In the months that followed, Charlie stayed out late at the pub most nights, and that was fine with her. She didn't thrill to the idea of his return from work. There was such tension in the apartment when they were together. His humor dimmed. Without her income, they had only enough money to cover food and the rent, and some weeks not even that much. She could tell he blamed her for it. Nora wondered where her sister had gone. She didn't know what to tell her father. Teresa didn't know anyone in this country other than them. "Until I come back," she had written. When would that be? In the beginning, Nora looked for her everywhere. She spent hours bouncing Patrick in front of the living room window, expecting to see her sister come up the road at any moment. She began to tell herself a story. When Teresa returned, she could have the baby. Nora would go away, leave this all behind, do what she ought to have done in the first place, if she had been brave enough. The baby had colic and ear infections and croup. She was forever calling the doctor. One morning when she had been up all night with him, she sat down and cried at the table after Charlie left for work. Her sister had trapped her here, and there was nothing she could do. What was she so afraid of? Why didn't she ever say boo to anyone? She should have let the baby go. By trying to save things, she had made a mess of it all. She went to the medicine cabinet in the bathroom for an aspirin. Her sister's pink lipstick lay abandoned on the bottom shelf. Teresa had made her try it once, before their first Dudley Street dance. Nora took the tube in hand now and lifted the lid. She ran the color over her lips as she looked in the mirror. "Let's get your coat," she said to the baby. She pushed the pram faster than she ever had, all the way to the Edison plant. When they arrived at the building, massive, boxy, windowless, the color of fog, Nora pushed open the heavy front door and guided the pram inside. "I need to talk to Walter McLean," she said to the secretary in the main office. The secretary blinked. "I don't know who that is, ma'am." "He works here. Go find him, or I'll scream." The woman looked alarmed. She scrambled to her feet. Walter appeared several minutes later. "Hello," he said. "You wanted to see me?"
"I'm Teresa Flynn's sister."
"Is that right?" he said, trying to sound jovial, as if they were two old friends. He eyed the secretary. "Let's go outside, shall we?" They stood on the steps of the building.
"Teresa is gone," she said. "No one has seen her."
"I haven't seen her," he said, defensive. "Since?"
"Oh, I know that."
Walter pointed at the carriage, peering inside. "Is this the baby? Her baby?" The baby was so clearly his, if anyone's, but he wouldn't dare say it.
"He's my husband Charlie's boy," she said, "and mine."
Nora hadn't blushed. Her sister wasn't here to say the words for her. She would say them for herself.
"You owe me something," she said. "What Patrick deserves. That's his name, Patrick."
"What is it you want?" he said.
"I don't know yet, but someday I'll know, and you'll give it." "You can't unsee what happened. I won't let you. I just wanted to tell you that."
"Dear Una, after all your years living in town, I wonder how you find the farm. I suppose it's the opposite way for me here. When I first arrived, the strangest part of this new place was the light. It was so bright, even at midnight. I shut the curtains, shut my eyes,
and still it never seemed to get dark. I thought of how at home the nights were black, with nothing to illuminate objects near or far. You closed your eyes, and you opened them, and there was no difference in what you saw. The streets are so busy here. There are too many strangers in the house. Yet, I am mostly alone. One thing no one prepares you for with a child is how alone you'll be. How overwhelmed, and yet how bored. But I try to keep busy and happy. I miss home. And you. Yours, Nora. Dear Nora, the big news from here is that Malby Manufacturing is sending me and a few other married girls to Shannon to get trained as overlockers. They'll set me up with a special machine to use at home once I'm back, so I can do all the hardest hems and seams right from my own kitchen table. It was difficult being out here in the country at first, and as you know, that was the least of my difficulties. I'll confess to you that I was properly miserable in the beginning. But after you left, my mother said I must make my happiness here. Bloom where you're planted, she told me. I have tried my very best. I hope I will see you before long, somehow, PG. With love, Una. Nora ran her fingers over the PG. Please, God. She prayed for the same. Teresa had left Aunt Nellie's prayer cards behind on the kitchen windowsill. Whenever she had a spare moment, Nora used them and tried to speak to God the way Aunt Nellie did. Some days she swore it was working. Others, her prayers only felt like wishes sent off into nothing. As he got older, Patrick cried less. She could reason with him, make him laugh. She began to take pleasure in the way he showed such simple wonder at all things, a car, a bird, a yellow dandelion growing out of a crack in the sidewalk. Somehow, it felt like magic when for the first time he did what every other child did, took a step, grew a tooth. I'm your mother now, she said, trying to convince him. And herself. Nora longed for her own mother in a way she hadn't since she was a child. She recalled her mother's sternness, her competence, and attempted to imitate it. All the time she had spent looking after her brother and sister had been no preparation for this. She thought of poor Teresa, who had never had any mother but her. Nora missed her sister's sparkle. All the color in her life came from Patrick now.
Mama,
he called her, and her heart swelled. His first word, said over and over again like a prayer. One Saturday morning she awoke on her own, the sun already bright outside the window. Nora was amazed. The baby had outslept her. She stepped into the kitchen. Charlie was feeding Patrick a bottle, telling him a story about a difficult customer as if he were a sympathetic pal.
"And I told her, peach is no color for a house, ma'am," he said. "I told her, pale yellow, now that is what you'll wish you'd gotten if you don't do it now." She went with the peach.
He looked up and saw Nora there, smiling.
"You got up with him?" she said. "We thought we'd let you sleep in today and have a morning chat, man to man."
She pointed at the bottle. "How do you even know how to do that?"
"What, warm a bit of milk up on the stove a minute? I did it for my younger brother all the time. Jack only got as fat as he did because of me and my way with the bottle."
Nora was flooded with warmth for him. It surprised her to find that there were parts of Charlie she did not know.
This became their Saturday morning routine. When Nora came out of the bedroom and saw the two of them at the table each week, she felt something like love. Whenever Charlie got a paycheck, he left her a quart of Brigham's vanilla ice cream in the icebox, and when she emptied it, he left another in its place. She noticed that his easy laughter was returning as he told silly stories to their son. He started telling his bad jokes again, and Nora tried to laugh. They came to a peaceful acceptance. They had made a decision that would fuse them for the rest of their lives. They could choose to be content with it or not. 2 years after they were married, Nora stood at the sink washing dishes. Charlie came home from the pub. She could hear him taking his coat off in the hall, then walking quietly toward her so as not to wake Patrick. She was about to say that his dinner was on the counter as he entered the kitchen, but before she could speak, Charlie smiled at her strangely, walked right over and kissed her, holding on to her longer than usual. Nora took his hand, led him into the bedroom. If she didn't do it now, she might never. She didn't turn on the light. When they made love, he touched her as if afraid she would break or possibly change her mind. Afterward, he petted her cheek. "Nora Flynn," he said, addressing her by her old name, which she still thought of as her real name. "The only girl I ever loved."
"Oh, go on," she said.
"It's the truth. I loved you from the first time I saw you." Her sister would laugh at her, for all the times she had wondered why Charlie had married her, made the sacrifices he did, Nora had never once considered that this might be the reason. She wondered if it was true. He didn't show love like a man in a movie might. Still, he had done something extraordinary for her. From then on, they kept to their separate beds, but every so often, one of them or the other would creep across in the dark. "Bloom where you're planted," she told herself every day. Bit by bit, it worked. From the time Patrick was a month old, people asked when she was going to have another. For so long it didn't happen, and Nora assumed it never would. She had worried about becoming pregnant too fast. But in the end, she felt silly for ever having been afraid. When Patrick was 4 and she found out she was going to have a baby, her first thought surprised her. She worried that she could never love another child as much as she loved him. When she saw John in the hospital, red-faced and wrapped in a white blanket, the delight in Charlie's eyes frightened her. She knew what he was thinking.
"He's the spitting image of me as a baby," he said, beaming.
She thought of Patrick. He didn't look like her husband at all. As she was putting him to bed her first night home from the hospital, Nora said, "Do you know why I named you Patrick?"
"Because that's the middle name of my only brother, Martin. And when I first saw you, I thought of how much you looked like him. You could be twins. Of course, he's a lot bigger than you are. He's 25 years old."
25?
Patrick said, in awe at the thought of a number so vast. He asked her for a picture. She told him she would find one and hoped he would forget. So the seed was planted, and every now and then she tended to it, reminding him of this fact that was not a fact, but seemed like one the more she said it. At some point, Nora stopped worrying that her sister would never come back, and instead began to fear that someday
she would.
Chapter 11. A week before she left Boston, Teresa rounded the corner after work and ran straight into Walter McLean, out walking with his wife and child. She had just noticed, pulling on her coat, that she had spilled something down the right side of her blouse. She wiped away the liquid, leaving a shadowy stain. When she looked up, there he was, laughing at something his wife had said. She was a tall and slender brunette, holding a baby with black hair, just like Patrick's. Walter didn't see Teresa, or anyway, he didn't acknowledge her. He just kept strolling along, as if no one had passed. In that moment of recognition, such an unfolding of emotions, "I know him. It's him. Oh, God, him. Will he?" No. Relief that turned quickly to despair. She realized then that she hadn't spilled anything. It was her milk seeping through her shirt from inside. Already she had felt that she was coming undone. She never slept anymore. She was up all night, waiting for Patrick's cries to pierce the silence, her heart racing. There were visions that refused to leave her, lying on the table, left for dead, the nurses pretending she wasn't there as she screamed in pain, everyone pretending. She found small tumbleweeds of hair on her pillow when she woke in the morning. When she looked in the mirror, she could see the white shock of her scalp in places. After she gave birth, she bled for 6 weeks. She had no idea if this was normal, and there was no one she could ask. She wanted to tell Nora, but her sister was so angry that Teresa didn't dare. She wondered if she might die. Part of her hoped she would, that they might come in one morning and find her, pale and bloodless, in her bed. That last morning at St. Margaret's was like a half-forgotten dream she could not piece together no matter how she tried. If she could only manage to do this, she thought, then maybe she could make sense of what happened. "I'll leave now," she had said, even after they'd gotten home from the hospital. "I'll take Patrick and I'll go." But she felt weary, light-headed. Her plan seemed deranged. Where would she go? How would she manage? So she cared for the baby at night, at home, when no one could see. In the beginning, that was enough. She only wanted to keep him close. Again and again she reminded herself of this fact. When she was strong enough, she would take him away. But when she saw Walter, Teresa doubted she would ever be strong again. Days later, Aunt Nellie died. Sitting in the church as she was eulogized, something broke in Teresa. Patrick cried and she felt her milk come. She wanted to snatch him from her sister's arms, but everyone was watching. She stared straight ahead to keep from crying. The tears spilled out of her anyway. The tears and the milk. Her body turned to liquid, washing away the last bit of herself she could remember. It was torture, listening to Charlie tell the story of Nora giving birth. 15 minutes. She knew Nora hated it, too. Nora hated all of it. She hated Patrick. Her sister's last words to her would stick in Teresa's mind. "Of course I don't want him." It occurred to her then that she would have to leave without the baby. They would all be better off. If her sister was ever going to love Patrick, they couldn't continue on this way. She knew where she would go. She took the envelope from a drawer, the return address scrawled in the upper left-hand corner. It was not a home, but a school. St. Hugo of the Hills. Teresa gathered the clothing Babs had given her and all the money she had saved, which wasn't much. She left a note for Nora. Then she crept into Patrick's room, her bag weighing on her shoulder. For years to come, she would remember the sight of the baby sleeping in his crib. An angel. She longed to take him with her, though she knew she couldn't manage it yet. She took his miraculous medal from the top dresser drawer instead. Something to remember him by. She slipped it into her coat pocket. Teresa hoped he knew somehow that she would be back to get him. She debated whether or not to kiss his cheeks, knowing that she might wake him. She did it anyway, feeling his soft, soft skin against her lips, hearing his cries begin just as she shut the front door and ran. She rode the train to South Station and sat on the steps amidst the bums and the drunks and the occasional crowd of late-night travelers coming off a bus. She didn't much care what anyone did to her, but no one did a thing. Occasionally she saw a figure coming toward her and thought it must be Nora, come to take her home. But then the woman would come closer, and she would see that it was a stranger. Teresa pulled the envelope from her pocket, read the letter. It was nearly a year old now.
"Please look me up if ever you find yourself in Queens."
As morning broke, she went to the ticket counter and asked for a one-way fare to New York. She rode with her bag on the empty seat beside her to discourage company. They had made this journey in reverse 2 years ago, Nora and Charlie in the front seat and her in the back, looking out the window, taking it all in. Now, she faced straight ahead, eyes squeezed shut. Teresa stood waiting on the steps of St. Hugo of the Hills when school let out. She watched the door for close to an hour, wondering if her friend even worked here anymore. Finally, Abigail came out, blonde curls bobbing, tortoiseshell glasses on her nose, just as she had been on the ship when they met. Teresa recalled the hours they'd spent gossiping on the deck, the boys they mooned over in the ballroom.
"Abigail,"
she said loudly, grabbing her arm when she got close. Abigail seemed frightened, pulling away. She didn't recognize her. Teresa had another memory now, of the day the letter arrived, her sister scolding her.
"She's only being polite. She's not inviting you."
"It's Teresa," she said, "from the boat to New York." Abigail cocked her head. Finally, she smiled.
"What in the world?" she said. "What are you doing here?"
She hugged Teresa, invited her to come to her apartment for a cup of tea. As they walked along past a row of shops, Teresa caught their reflection in a glass storefront. Abigail was more or less unchanged, but Teresa looked like a different person.
"My sister died," she said, concocting a story on the spot. "I'm on my own now. That's why I've come to you. I didn't know where else to go."
Abigail looked stricken.
"That poor girl.
I remember. She wasn't well. She said she was engaged at last and would be leaving the city soon. They had already bought a house in New Jersey, not far from her in-laws."
"It isn't fair how some people end up with so much," she said, "while others..."
"I want to help you. You're a good girl, Teresa. You don't deserve this." The timing was the first stroke of good fortune she had had in ages.
Abigail arranged it so that Teresa took over her job when she left, teaching ninth grade. She moved into Abigail's studio apartment. The building was tall and beige and uninspiring. The cramped apartment was on the 14th floor. Her view was of a billboard advertising Swanson TV dinners. An illustration of a woman 20 feet tall and yet somehow still dainty, wearing a pink dress, smiling at a box of frozen chicken and potatoes as if it were a puppy. Behind her, a dopey husband with his golf clubs signaled to a pal in the doorway that he could stay. "Extra guest for dinner? You're ready for him." Abigail left behind the bed and the dresser and the kettle, as well as a list of all the places Teresa could go to meet people from home. There were Irish pubs and clubs all over this part of New York, but she didn't wish to visit them. She wanted nothing to do with the Irish now, or with anyone. Teresa rarely saw the people who lived in the apartments around her, but she could smell their strange cooking through the walls, could hear the booming voices, words spoken in languages she couldn't comprehend. It gave her a start when a voice was raised or an object dropped on the floor up above her head. Everyone was a stranger to her now. The world seemed menacing in a way it hadn't before. The school looked like a prison or a factory. She thought of the country schoolhouses back home, of the pupils a teacher might know not just for a year, but from the time they were babies until the age of 10 or 11. There, a teacher had a hand in shaping them. But here, they were so rambunctious, so old, already formed. They didn't mind her, no matter how she tried. Some mornings she dreamed of finding a way to board a ship back to Ireland. She imagined tucking into a plate of her grandmother's barmbrack, studded with raisins. She could almost taste it. Teresa missed the sound of her voice, how she muttered in Irish when she didn't want the children to know what she was saying. But she didn't write home to tell them where she'd gone. She wondered what Nora had told them. By now they must know she had run away. Teresa would speak to them all when she was ready, when the time came for her to take Patrick back. Then they would tell everyone the truth. She missed the bustle around Mrs. Quinlan's dinner table. She missed Nora most of all. The safety of her. The one thing Teresa could be sure of in this world. Her entire life consisted of her pupils and her apartment. She didn't think she deserved any more than that. In the teacher's lounge, when girls talked about the men they were seeing and when they might propose, she sometimes wished to break into their conversations. But then she thought better of herself. What could she possibly say? Teresa ate lunch alone at school and dinner alone at home, forcing the food in. She ate oatmeal for dinner. She hardly knew how to prepare anything. Someone else had always done the cooking for her. Her sister, or Mrs. Quinlan, or her gran. Nothing tasted like anything. Sometimes she forgot to eat. She looked in the mirror and was surprised to see how gaunt she had become. Her breasts and stomach sagged like deflated balloons, but the rest of her was all sharp angles, bones pressing through skin. She went to church every few nights and prayed with a dozen old ladies. She said the Hail Mary until the words ceased to make any sense. Her sorrow was her one companion, ever present, making her arms and legs sore as if she'd just climbed a mountain. Some mornings it was a struggle to stand and get dressed. She slept and slept and slept. On the weekends, she slept all day, and then was awake at night, her heart pounding in her chest as she remembered it all, as she wondered what Nora and Patrick were doing at that minute. On more than one occasion, she had visions of cutting her wrists, or going up to the roof and jumping off. But this was a sin so grave that she tried to banish the thought as soon as it came. She saw before her the image of her younger self on her confirmation day, the bishop asking what happens if you die in a state of mortal sin, and Teresa cheerfully reciting the answer. "You go to hell," she said then with a smile, fully believing that no circumstance could ever befall her to make her enter into such a state. She carried Patrick's medal wherever she went, worrying it between her fingers, praying for him. Another St. Hugo's teacher lived in her building. For months they rode the elevator together most mornings by chance and walked to school a few staggered feet apart. The woman might smile at her, and Teresa would look down at the floor. One morning the woman said, "This is silly. I'm Kathy Tersey. I teach 11th grade." "Teresa Flynn," she said softly. "Ninth." They began to travel to and from work together on purpose after that. If the elevator doors didn't open on 14, Kathy waited for Teresa in the lobby. Their short walks were a highlight of her day, though she let Kathy do most of the talking. She was a few years older than Teresa. Kathy asked where she was from, whether she was dating anyone. Teresa was naturally inclined to tell all her stories to a new friend, but now she evaded even the most basic questions. "You're a mystery, aren't you?" Kathy said, undeterred. "That's all right. I'll figure you out eventually." Teresa wanted to be figured out, yet when, on a Tuesday night, Kathy invited her for dinner, she said no. For weeks, she declined Kathy's invitations, even though the old part of her wished she could go, wanted a friend. Then Kathy came to her door and said, "This time it's serious. I've been stood up by my boyfriend. I've got a pot roast for two in the oven, and I'm not in the mood to argue. You're coming over, and that's that." It was the first meal Teresa had shared with another person in 7 months. Kathy's apartment had the same layout as her own. She had warmed it up, hung pictures, dropped rugs, painted her walls a pale blue. The shelves were full of books. She had a sweet old cat that liked to curl up on the windowsill, basking in the sun. Teresa's place was empty. A faded square and a nail where each of Abigail's pictures once hung. The cold, bare floor against her feet each morning, a kind of penance. Now she wanted to lie down on Kathy's carpet and never leave. Kathy reminded Teresa of a more grown-up version of the woman she herself had once been. Everyone liked her. And for some reason, she liked Teresa. Having one friend made all the difference. She could feel herself returning when Kathy was there. It was in her nature to laugh, to flirt, to gossip, to be curious. Teresa grew afraid to be alone with her thoughts. Kathy's boyfriend, Arthur, was a truck driver who was gone 5 days a week, including weekends. Teresa and Kathy went to the 10 o'clock Mass at St. Hugo's together every Sunday and afterward to the diner on Grand Street for coffee and eggs. After Teresa had been in New York a year and a half, Arthur introduced her to a friend of his, Roger, a handsome American who worked as a policeman in the city. The four of them went dancing or to a movie in the early evening. Teresa let Roger kiss her, but not all the other things he wanted to do. He took her for an innocent, a virgin. Teresa never mentioned Nora or Patrick, or even that she had once lived in Boston, to anyone. The memory didn't leave her, but it faded some, enough so that she could breathe